Okay, good afternoon, folks. So what we're doing today, I've been thinking about how we can tackle Midsummer Night's Dream and get more hold of what's going on there. We're going to do some workshop activities, which are all on the sheet that you've got in front of you. But I just wanted to go over again. I don't know if I've been through all these points yet with you, but it's important that you kind of understand the broader context of what we're trying to look at in Midsummer Night's Dream. And just to go through some of these slides up here, first of all, you've got Blind Cupid there. Blind Cupid, which I've picked out of this Botticelli painting, Primavera, the Rite of Spring. And in Midsummer Night's Dream, there is this quote, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." And Blind Cupid, of course, is symbolic, mythological, explaining what? What does Blind Cupid explain? Love is blind. Love is blind. In this play, we've got the world of fairy, which is responsible for the blindness of love. Hermia and Lysander, Demetrius and Helena, their relationships become confused through the impact of some kind of divine or fairy-like inspiration. And yet Shakespeare says, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." So, you know, a question that this play raises is, what does Shakespeare think about human love? I mean, he's not attributing our foolishness to some kind of divine force, is he? Or is he simply using the world of fairy as a way of explaining the blindness that we experience on this earthly level? So there's a question about what is love, and that runs right throughout Shakespeare. We saw it in Antony and Cleopatra. Questions about what the nature of their love is. Is it some deep love, or is it based on lust, or is it based on politics, so on and so forth. There's the full painting of Primavera, which I'm actually going to see in 4 weeks' time, believe it or not. I've got a trip to Italy, and I'm going to go to the Uffizi in Florence. Those of you going to Rome, if you get a chance, go down to Florence and see this and other Botticelli paintings, which were inspirational really to the English Renaissance. So I think I've gone through this page here fairly well. We're looking at the way in which Midsummer Night's Dream has got these different languages, different registers, and the way that Shakespeare kind of deliberately seems to mix these up. So that in Act 1, Scene 1, you've got the language of the lovers, and then immediately afterwards in Act 1, Scene 2, you've got the language of the artisans, and then in Act 2, Scene 1, you've got the language of fairy. Shakespeare seems to almost deliberately enjoy taking us through a whole lot of different registers. A register is language used by a certain group of people, or language used in a certain context or situation. And language means the idioms that are used, the words that are chosen, the aesthetic or beautifying qualities that amplify the nature of the language in that given situation. In Act 2, Scene 2, he actually has these worlds come together. So the lovers and the fairy world impact on each other. Act 3, 1, you've got the fairy world impacting on the rustics or the working class. And then in Act 4, Scene 1, you've got this extraordinary speech, which we're going to look at today. Bottom's speech, which is in prose, and yet it's mystical. And it's got all sorts of hidden religious references in it. And is Shakespeare, through this speech, making fun of, you know, the religious, philosophical dimensions of human reality? Or is he maybe presenting us with the fact that at the bottom, there is where you find the truth. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Humility is endless. I don't think Bottom's very poor in spirit, mind you. But during the play as a whole, he seems to be so full of himself. And yet he comes out with this amazing speech at the end of Act 4, Scene 1. And all these various languages that I've talked about are, of course, embedded, beginning and end of the play, with the world of ancient Greece, the Italian court, Theseus, Hippolyta, and so on. And underpinning all this is this question about the nature of imagination, and that's something that we're going to be looking at today as well. So here are some of the key themes that we've already been outlining. There's this question of human folly, especially perhaps the fickleness of love, the fact that love in human situations is seemingly unstable. Certainly the play seems to present yet, and yet the play at the end seems to celebrate married love, love that comes to the right and proper conclusion. So Shakespeare seems to be very kind of wedded, I choose that word deliberately, wedded to the idea of some permanent love. That certainly comes out in The Tempest as well, when Prospero the magician engineers the love between his own daughter Miranda and the son of the king who was his enemy, Ferdinand. So Ferdinand and Miranda, they form a marriage which heals the world. So, you know, underpinning Shakespeare's stories about love, there is this idea that love is something that can cure hatred, anger, fragmentation. He seems to be committed to an idea that love is a saving grace in the world. And if you look at all of Shakespeare's tragedies, they are the opposite of that. There's Othello, where Othello becomes so filled with jealousy, anger, and rage that he kills his wife Desdemona, tragically. In the play, Shakespeare shows us what an incredible human being Othello is. He's a man of, you know, intelligence, integrity, and yet he's pulled down by jealousy. In King Lear, you've got this ancient king who has this deep love for his youngest daughter, Cordelia. And he's an aged king, and he's decided, you know, in his 80th year to divide his kingdom up to his three daughters. And crazy man that he is, he has a public ceremony where he invites his three daughters in a public forum to tell him how much each of them loves him. A crazy idea. So two of the daughters get up, Goneril and Regan, and they say, "Daddy, I love you so much. I love you more than I'll ever love anything else, blah, blah, blah." So he gladly gives them a third of the kingdom. But the daughter he loves most, his youngest daughter, Cordelia, right from the start, she doesn't want to have much to do with this kind of public show of affection. Lear turns to Cordelia, she's about 18 years old. He says to her, "You, youngest, most precious daughter of my heart, you tell me how much you love me so that you can earn your rightful third of the kingdom. What have you to say to me, Cordelia?" "Nothing, Daddy." "Nothing? Speak again or mar your fortune. Speak again. Tell me how much you love me. What have you to say?" "Nothing, Daddy." "Nothing? Nothing will come of nothing. Out of my kingdom!" And he blows it. He just loses it all in front of all his audience. He just goes completely berserk. His ego is so impacted by his youngest daughter daring to stand up against his demand for expression of love in front of an audience. It's not until the end of the play that he meets his daughter again. By this time, he's gone mad. Because the two daughters who told him how much they loved him, they've abused their position and they've treated him really, really badly. And they've thrown him out of their home. And in the last scene where he meets Cordelia again, just as England is going to war with France, he's crazy and she is near death because she gets hung at the end. And there's this painful scene where he cradles her and tells her that, you know, he made this terrible mistake 20 years ago. So that play is about, again, someone who's flawed in their capacity for love. Hamlet's the same. Hamlet, this tragedy of his relationship with Ophelia and with his mother. All the tragedies are about the failure of people to be free from their own ego. And that destroys their capacity for love. So the plays we're looking at, Antony and Cleopatra, Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest, they're all the opposite. The Antony and Cleopatra is seen to be a tragedy because Antony and Cleopatra both die at the end. But it's very much a play that looks at the value of love as opposed to politics. And I know some of you are still undecided as to which side of the equation you go on. Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest are much less ambiguous. They both celebrate love and they celebrate the outcome of love. But nevertheless, in Midsummer Night's Dream, we've still got this question in Act 3, Scene 2 that's provoked by the phrase, "Lord, what fools these mortals be, And tied up with that, of course, is this idea from As You Like It, which we saw emblazoned in the stained glass window, "All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players." So, you know, is that idea, is Shakespeare saying here that we're all on the stage, and because we're all on the stage, to what extent is our life our own? We're all play acting. There's something of that idea in Shakespeare, that we're all play acting. And that leads one to think, well, do we ever not play act? Are we ever truly ourselves? I think Shakespeare asks that question in The Tempest, because Prospero, who is the magician, who's got uses his imagination, at the end of that play, he actually gets off the stage, leaves the stage. And it's parallel with Shakespeare leaving the theatre and going back to Stratford. So there's a lot of ideas tied up in that. And of course, within A Midsummer Night's Dream, you've got a play being put on within the play. And hopefully we're going to get to that play within the play. Now that's foreshadowing something that I want to do next week. I've looked at our program, and in next week's program I was going to do Shakespeare's sonnets exclusively. But we've done a fair few of the sonnets. We might do a few more next week, but I want to spend the bulk of next week continuing on with Midsummer Night's Dream, because there's still a lot to explore in here. So here's a few further thoughts, which I think we actually went through these also last week, but just to refresh our memory. So there's Shakespeare's radicalism in love. What does that mean? Radicalism. Radicalism in the sense, certainly in Midsummer Night's Dream, that Hermia wants to love somebody that her father doesn't want. So Shakespeare is someone who likes kind of breaking the law, or likes to represent and value people who break the law. That's why when you've read Midsummer Night's Dream and you go back to Antony and Cleopatra, you might be swayed within the context of Shakespeare's works to think, well, hang on a second, he likes people who break out of the law, Antony's breaking out of the law, so is Shakespeare really, you know, putting a big tick next to Antony's relationship with Cleopatra? That seems to be the way that Shakespeare's works as a whole would make one think about Antony and Cleopatra, rather than the other way of seeing his love for Cleopatra being a failure of his political nerve. Romeo and Juliet, of course, radical, daring to confront family traditions and family rules. These, how can these two people dare to be in love with each other? So Shakespeare kind of enjoyed stirring the pot and challenging people to think outside the restrictive box. And challenged to the extreme morality of the Puritans. Well, you know, Shakespeare was living at a time when the Puritans were quite big in England. A lot of them sailed off to America in 1620 on the Mayflower to set up a new colony that was kind of more strict and rigorous in its religious practice. But Shakespeare himself didn't like the Puritans, and there are a lot of characters in his plays. I'm thinking in particular of Malvolio in Twelfth Night, who Shakespeare satirizes mercilessly for their so-called prudery. And then, you know, the question, what is true love? I mean, this is a big question for everybody. What is true love? You know, love is bandied around in our society as a word that, you know, is used for cosmetic purposes, is used for selling all sorts of things. But what is the nature of love? And does Shakespeare in his plays explore this aspect of human experience? And, you know, I could ask, what is the right basis for love? Is it intuition, like Hermia's love for Lysander? Is it physical attraction, like Antony's love for Cleopatra, or Miranda's attraction for Ferdinand in The Tempest? Are there social and economic factors that kind of predispose love? So the play doesn't give a simple answer to this question. Is passion or desire more important than reason in human affairs? What role does authentic love have? And you know, one sort of always, you kind of think back to Shakespeare's own life. And he married a woman who was older than him by about nearly a decade and had two children with her, and then left to go to Stratford. And who knows what his life of relationships was there. We get some sense in his sonnets and his plays that he had bisexual relations. We don't really know much about it, but certainly his plays are exploring all this. So in Midsummer Night's Dream, of course, you've got a clear distinction between love that's freely chosen and love that's enforced. Now, Hermia resists enforced love, but Hippolyta, it seems, has accepted enforced love. She's been captured by Theseus. It's not part of the story, but we learn about it through, you know, what's said, the background. She's the queen of the Amazons who's been captured by Theseus, and she sort of accepts it. He doesn't say much against it. And there she is. She's got Theseus, her husband, making these demands of her. But she does have a voice in the play. And she has a very important voice in the play. In fact, in the last act, where Theseus talks about the nature of imagination. Why does he talk about imagination? He talks about imagination because... Go, tell us, Helena. Sorry. Go, please. Yep. He doesn't believe the lovers.
He doesn't believe the lovers at all, like, and just as how the players don't believe what about the fairies and all the things that they witnessed. While Apollo was like, what? Magic is a thing.
That's right.
I mean, they don't understand it, but it is a thing that we understand. I did read an article where it said that because of who Theseus is historically,
yeah,
maybe just have, and how Puck is a very, he's an English figure from like Wales.
Yep.
He may not just not get exposed to those sort of fairy creatures, but say Hippolyta, who's the queen of the Amazons, there is a sort of mythical aspect to Amazonian law, which is like, yeah, this happens. I expect them to be one.
Yep. Good, very good. So Theseus is a rational person who doubts magical impact of anything. And These are the lines that are perhaps some of the most famous lines in all of Shakespeare. Hippolyta begins in Act 5, Scene 1. They've just listened to Hermia and Helena and Lysander and Demetrius explaining why they love who they do. And Hippolyta says, "'Tis strange, my Theseus, that or what these lovers speak of. And Theseus says, more strange than true. I never may believe these antique fables, nor these fairy toys. So he's never going to believe, you know, these mythological tales or these tales about fairies. And then he says, and these are the most famous, some of the most famous lines in Shakespeare, lovers and madmen have such seething brains, such shaping fantasies, that apprehend or imagine more than cool reason ever comprehends. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet. Those three figures, if you think about it for a moment, the lunatic, the madman, the lover, the poet, are of imagination all compact. That imagination drives the world of the lunatic, the lover, and the poet. And they see more than cool reason ever comprehends. So what's interesting here is that Shakespeare actually uses Theseus to push one of his, Shakespeare's, key ideas, that imagination has a power to see more than reason does, a power to see more truth than reason can see. And yes, it is rather like the way a lover sees a world, or even a lunatic sees a world. And a lunatic, by definition, is kind of outside the framework of accepted society. So it's interesting that Theseus speaks the words that one could imagine Shakespeare saying about imagination and the power of imagination, because the whole of Shakespeare's work is the work of imagination, imagination that has in a profound way tried to look at, represent, and perhaps even cure the world. Now, that might be going too far, to cure the world. But if you look at the tragedies, he's showing us by example what not to do, and in the comedies, he's showing us by example what to do. That's a crude simplification. But something of that is there in what Theseus is saying. However, what's ironic is that Theseus actually disagrees with what he's saying. Theseus himself does not believe that. He doesn't believe in the imagination. So just looking at the screen again up here, this play, as well as Antony and Cleopatra, embodies a view of women being independent in a male-dominated world and women challenging male authority. It's not true of The Tempest. And this play depicts and assesses males in power, Theseus, Aegeus. And this play shows that reason is rather limiting compared to the world of imagination and feeling. Hermia argues convincingly for the supremacy of the soul over law and reason in Act 1, Scene 1, Line 83. My soul consents not to give sovereignty to her lordship's unwished yoke. So Shakespeare is privileging, in Hermia's speech, the power of the soul to know the truth as opposed to reason. And she continues, she says, oh hell to choose love by another's eyes. So it's really challenging the whole, you know, centuries-long tradition of the fact that, you know, women are paired off to males by decree of their father. And here's what I was just talking about a moment ago, Theseus's speech. Theseus equates lovers and poets as people of imagination with lunatics. He's a rationalist who has no time for anything that cannot be factually explained. And Hippolyta, at the end of this speech, she turns round and she challenges Theseus. And we're left with that sense that her challenge is strong and is worth listening to. Hippolyta insists on the fact that the imaginative story that the four young lovers tell about what happened to them in the woods has something that goes beyond delusion. And then the play, of course, ends with the spirit world, this world of fairy, with Puck speaking. So, who's come in late? Anybody not got this handout yet?
So, the way we're going to work for the rest of today, which is both now and... Have you got this for a show? Yeah. I've got the sheet here. So, this task is similar to what we did in Anti-Egypt Park, but there are some differences. So the task itself, you're all going to be given a part within a scene. You have to perform your part in the extract which you've been given. That's the first thing. You have to be able to tell the whole group when you come back to tell the story of your part. So if you're Hermia, for example, you tell us exactly what Hermia has said. Describe as best you can the language you use for your part, because each of you is going to play a different part and you have a different language. So, as best you can, without getting too long-winded about it, what sort of language have you been forced to use in taking that part? Colloquial language? Is it the language of fear? And if so, what sort of words? So, be on the lookout for how you are being asked to utilize language. And then the last thing is that for each group, I have written a question, a specific question. And in your group, you're going to talk about the answer to that question. You're going to nominate one person in the group to tell the whole class the answer to that question. That's broad. The purpose of the workshop is to give you the opportunity to work closely together, to establish a precise meaning of the text. This is how professional actors work in their preparation for rehearsal and performance. Look up the meaning of the words and phrases using more than other online resources. The purpose is to allow you to experience how your physical body is vitally important component to bringing the meaning of the text to life. And the purpose is also to allow you to experience how changes in pace, volume, gesture, etc. can radically alter the meaning of the text. Okay, that was from the Anti-Meaningful Craft workshop. And here's the specific task. Each group will be able to make a short setting of the play. Here are the steps. One, in your group, study the characters and make their decision on who will play which role. There's going to be no director this time. So they can use the reading sign to make that role. I meant to leave out the director's role. Leave it out. Put a pin through it. Number two, immediately, do an active rehearsal of the scene. Don't sit me around doing this reading simply. Immediately get into the stage version. Do an active rehearsal of the scene. Each scene is about 80 lines long. It shouldn't take more than 10 or 15 minutes to go through it. Make suggestions on what is needed to bring more life and meaning into the performance. So the director here is the whole group. You are the whole group is the director. You are the director's real scene. Three, clarify meanings of words and phrases with the group as a whole. Then, as a group, discuss the specific question and nominate one person in the group to answer that question. So when you finish the group exercise, everybody in the group has responsibility to say what character they're playing, what the character is doing in that scene, and what specific sort of language that you're using. Character, purpose, language, those two things. It doesn't need to take long, it says about 3 minutes. And then in your group, nominate one person who picks up what we've discussed is the response to the question your group has been given. Fourth, to the whole group, tell the story of your part, briefly describe the language. For example, elevate the vocal example, then you try the example of the language you use. And then the nominated person answers the allocated question. Here are the scenes. I've got four scenes here. And then we will... Let's see how you go. So we've got... You can decide on who plays what part. Robin, Helena, Demetrius, Alexander, Hermia, so you are group A, and don't have to stick to those lines. And there's your question. There's the scene, Act 2, Scene 2. Now, I've got copies, if you forgot to bring your copy from last week. If you forgot to bring your copy from last week, I've got copies here. B, Titanic's bottom, D's bottom, mustard seed, orange. Okay, you there's your question. C, Odysseus, Hippolyta, Aegeus, Lysander, Demetrius. So, you have a double. So look, I suggest that it's now 12:36. It would be good if you could try and finish up by, let's say, 12:05. Then we'll have time to speed back to each of the series. You can go outside if you want, you can go anywhere you like.
There is a test, maybe. It's 2:02.
Just before I forget, because I have forgotten and now I'm reminded, have everybody's attention for one moment. Owen, attention for one moment. Next Friday, that is before I see you again, at 10 o'clock in the morning, there's the meeting for the New York group. And I'm not sure if a room's been allocated, but look into Leo. If you want to go, look into Leo and find out the details. All right, on with your performance.
Yeah. it's on your own.